They say you should not be put in jail for the rest of your life for murder or anything else. There should be no death penalty because it was a learning experience. And having gone through that learning experience, you're a better person now. This is what they teach.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Britain's part of the US coalition bombing Syria now, but is our real target ISIS, Assad or Putin? We collect together some experts on the region this evening to untangle the web of this bombing campaign without clear priorities or long-term military plan, which Britain's alliance with so-called moderate jihadis threatens to turn Syria into another Libya or Iraq. And as we go into the festive season with the bloody Paris attacks fresh in our memory, but only the police and press's word for who really carried them out, we ask, are we entering a new era where terror attacks like 9/11, 7/7 and Paris begin to happen so fast and furious that everyone's dead and there are no proper trials and nobody has time to question police and TV reports before it's time for the next one? Sounds a bit like Iraq right now, doesn't it? And where our ignoring international law just creates more recruits to the extremist cause. And have the jihadis got a point? Are our own corporations, banks and governments becoming so despotic they pose a danger to humanity? Plus Martin Summers' weekly chance if he wishes to take us on a tour of other hotspots, but we're certainly sticking mainly with Syria in the second hour of this programme. I'm pleased to introduce anti-war campaigner Mehrnaz Shahabi. Hi Mehrnaz, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thank you.
Now I know you were born in Iran. How do you think you view what's going on in Syria now being in the UK but being born in Iran?
Well, what is happening in Syria is really tragic. After what we experienced in Iraq and in Libya recently, in 2011, seeing the replay of that in Syria is really is tragic for the loss of word. And also, I think whatever is happening to Syria is really a prelude for a similar scenario being played out in Iran.
I wonder what you make of the comment I made at the top of the hour, which is, who are we really after? Is it ISIS? Is it Assad? Or is it Putin? I mean, you mentioning also the country you were born in, Iran, too.
Who Britain is targeting? Well, I think that Britain is really has been instigating the whole scenario in Syria. It has been collaborating with the jihadists. And, for example, we know of the former French foreign minister, Roland Dumas, who said that in 2013, on a trip to Britain, the British offered him collaboration in regime change in Syria.
Well, just to make that absolutely clear, he said it on television in 2013, but he was talking way back to 2009.
That's right, absolutely, absolutely. That is before the problems started in Syria, and actually also from WikiLeaks documents, we know that the regime change agenda in Syria goes at least as early as 2005. by financing the NGOs, preparing them for regime change, and also arming the Sunni opposition, trying to create conflicts between different ethnic and religious groups in Syria.
Well, some would argue, Manas, that those conflicts were there already, and it's the fact that the government of Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and also, of course, that, that there's been a pushing of the Syrian government back to Damascus, away from large areas of Syria, that actually those that, because there is no effective government in those areas, that those conflicts were there anyway.
The conflicts in Syria. The conflicts in Syria did not. Bashar Assad was a very popular government. Of course, we can't say that it was. What government is absolutely popular with everyone or hasn't got any problems? But we didn't have bombings and ethnic strife. There wasn't a civil war situation in Syria. There were legitimate grievances and there were protests, but jihadists and armed opposition groups were inserted into the protests right from the start, and they militarized the situation. In fact, a lot of people refer to the situation in Daraa, that they say that the Syrian government shot at the demonstrators. But in fact, there are witnesses, including an Italian priest who had been living in Syria for 50 years, and he says that it was actually the jihadists that they were in the crowd shooting at the demonstrators and the police. So there is a lot of evidence about these people having been inserted into the crowd, and we hardly hear anything about the killing of Syrian police, the army, and the citizens.
Well, it sounds to me as if a lot of the judicial process in all of this is just simply not happening, whether it's on a local or an international level, and it's just being left up to the international press, a lot of it the London-based, New York based press to decide what's really happened. And I'm joined on the line also by Dan Glazebrook, who's author of Divide and Ruin and a journalist himself. Hi Dan, welcome to the Politics
Hi.
Show.
Can you
give us your take on what the real objectives are in Syria? We've got several on the plate at the moment, on the table should I say. We've got possibly ISIS, possibly Assad, and possibly a longer game with Putin.
Well, the target of the regime change in Syria is still Assad, is still the regime, is still the government. It's the Syrian state is the target, and has been since, as Maynard said, 4 years ago, the West and its allies in the region began inserting armed fighters and flooding weapons into the hands of the most sectarian militias in the region, and funneling them into Syria. To destabilize and bring down the Syrian state. That's been the agenda for the last 4 years. It was done under the cover, initially, of peaceful protests, some were peaceful, some were not. But from the start, that's what it's been. It's been an insertion of sectarian militias armed and funded and trained by the West and its regional allies. And that's still exactly what's going on today. If you look at Cameron, what he said in the House of Commons last Wednesday, he was very explicit. Right from the first few minutes, he admitted the ultimate goal is still, in his the euphemisms they always talk in, his goal is Assad. They'd like to personalize it. What he means by that is the ultimate goal is still to destroy the Syrian state, just as the goal in Iraq was not Saddam, was not the target. The target was the destruction of the Iraqi state, which was achieved. And the goal in 2011, the target was not Gaddafi as such, although it was important that both of those figures were killed. And I don't think they'll leave Syria until Assad himself is personally killed. But they're not the be-all and end-all of the target. The target of the West is the Syrian state itself. And they won't leave either until they feel that Syria has been crippled and prevented from any time in the future being a genuine regional power that can represent its people, that can forge its own independent foreign policy, support the Palestinians, make alliances with the Global South, which is what Syria's been punished for. So that was the agenda in 2011, going back to 2009, according to Ronald Dumas, as you say, is the agenda today. And ISIS is just a cover, it's a ruse. Speaker after speaker in the House of Commons pointed out, ISIS are nowhere near, that the 70,000 so-called moderate troops that Cameron talks about, are nowhere near ISIS. He says they're going to be leading the fight against ISIS, but these are people whose only, all we know about them, is that they're committed to killing Syrian soldiers and police, and often members of rival religious faiths as well. That's all we know about them. Their relations are a bit hot-cold with ISIS, because ISIS is not their target any more than ISIS is the West's target. Their target and the Western government's target is still the Syrian state. So, yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. Cameron made it very clear. Just want to finish, if I may, on this point that Frank Field raised in Parliament, Labour MP. Very interesting. He said, look, the strategy of the US over the past year when they've been bombing ISIS is to, whenever they see that ISIS are massacring Syrian soldiers, to leave them to it, give them a free hand, not bomb them when they're doing that. Right? So, and he was, Frank Field asked, will this be the British strategy? And Cameron's weasel-worded answer basically implied, yes, I'd encourage your listeners to read it on Hansard for themselves. He basically didn't say no, right? He didn't deny that that would be their strategy, to give ISIS a free hand so long as it's slaughtering Syrian and police. And at the same time, he explicitly said these 70,000 fighters who are anti-Assad fighters, they're not anti-ISIS fighters, the RAF will be their air force. We were going to give air cover to them. So the way I see it, you see the Syrian opposition groups, the rebel groups, the militias in Syria, anti-government militias, divided into three. And the British government strategy towards how it uses each of those in this big grand play of regime change is slightly different in each case. So you've got these 70,000 that Cameron said, yep, we will, you know, continue to pour weapons into their hand, train them. William Hague talked about the possibility of special forces inserted on the ground, which I'm sure there are already, but openly doing that to a much larger extent to help organize them more effectively, and the RAF will give them air cover. That's open and explicit. Those are the people we're going to directly support. Now, the wording of the motion said ISIS will be the exclusive target of airstrikes, meaning Al-Qaeda, which has actually led the main territorial gains that have taken place in Syria this year against the government, has been a new Al-Qaeda-forged alliance called the Army of Conquest, with help from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, in which many of the groups that Cameron openly supports are part of that Al-Qaeda-led alliance. And Al-Qaeda will not be targeted by airstrikes, so they'll be given an open and free hand. And at the same time, ISIS will be bombed only in as much as they cause disunity in the ranks of the death squads, only in as much as they fight against these other hand-picked militias of Cameron's. As long as they're focused on fighting and killing Syrian soldiers, they'll be given a free hand. So this is the kind of grand strategy by which Britain and the US and its regional partners hope to unify all of these opposition groups, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and push them towards smashing the Syrian state even more effectively. And the airstrikes are part of that grand strategy, part and parcel of it, a carrot and stick approach to ISIS. Please go ahead and massacre Syrian soldiers, we'll leave you alone, but don't attack the other anti-government fighters who we're going to help in a big push on Assad as well, directly.
But you see, since the Russians are backing Assad up, effectively, an enormous superpower, nuclear power, backing Assad up, isn't this inevitably, ultimately, going to lead to the Western powers, the NATO powers, coming into conflict with the Russians, because the Russians are not going to allow Assad now to be overthrown, particularly because of their, I think it's Tarsus, their base, which really gives the Russians access to the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yeah.
I mean, even Napoleon was trying to push out, hundreds of years ago, push the Russians out from having influence in that region, and Turkey and Eastern Europe. And the Russians are definitely not going to allow their influence in the Middle East to go, Dan. I wonder what you make of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why it's building up to a very, very tense affair over the past, how far back do you want to go? Since at least 1917, Russia has been a target of Western containment, contain its power, strip it of its influence and try and weaken it and destroy it, really. That hasn't particularly changed since the end of the Cold War, and especially it's got worse under Putin, not because of anything Putin's done, but except for the fact that he's shown that he's not going to be pushed around and he wants to have independent foreign policy. So things are hotting up, and there is the potential for a clash You're absolutely right. But Syria's really the... an Assyrian who actually moved to the UK said something that really made sense to me. She said Syria's become the Stalingrad, really, of the modern era, the era of imperialist war. You know, Syria may well be become the Stalingrad of the regime changes. You know, the regime change that actually doesn't take place because of, yes, Russian support, yes, Iranian and Hezbollah support, but also the steadfastness of the Russian people themselves. And in that regard, it's worth noting that the so-called... Now, one of the things in the House of Commons debate that was totally torn to shreds was Cameron's assertion that there were 70,000 moderate fighters. The military chiefs who gave him that figure didn't even claim that. When they were questioned by some of the committees, they admitted that over half of them could in no way be termed moderates, basically. And I would argue that de facto none of them can be called moderates because there's nothing moderate about going and killing soldiers and police.
They're even called the opposition, aren't they? The Syrian opposition.
Yeah, exactly. Not opposition to ISIS.
I don't think they're
opposition
quite like
the government.
The Labour Party. I can't imagine them sitting in the Houses of Parliament all with automatic rifles. I mean, it's not quite...
Well, this is the thing, is that people say, oh, there's very few moderates left in Syria now after 4 years of civil war. And that's true, but that's not only true because they've been killed or radicalised. That's true because in 2012, Assad launched a serious programme of reforms that pretty much met all of the demands of the original peaceful protests, which allowed multi-party elections, ended the one-party state, you know, brought other parties into parliament and coalition government. You've got the Communist Party now is involved, other parties, the national coordinating committees who set up some of those initial peaceful protests were brought on board into a peaceful process of negotiating, and actually out of those negotiations came a serious package of reforms. And that's where the moderates have gone. They haven't just been wiped out or become radicalized. They've actually realized what's going on, and they've become critical supporters of the government side in the civil war because they see it's designed to undermine the whole fabric of their society.
But Dan, what about...
So the moderates are there, but they're working with the government.
What about this claim many people made? Actually, quite a lot of the students and pupils, from school pupils that had turned out in a protest, 500 of them on College Green here in Bristol on Wednesday evening, saying, well, actually, this is going to help as a recruitment tool for ISIS. They're bombing innocent civilians. That's effectively what happens, is that people start actually saying, well, they start queuing up at the door of ISIS saying, we want to join.
Well, absolutely. And this has been the genius, the evil genius, really, of the Western states and how they've manipulated forces of radicalized political Islam that have, you know, for very good reasons, come to understand that the you know, the Western states are the enemies of their countries, which happen to be Muslim countries. So that's not only a narrative, it happens also to be a fact, right? The West has been undermining those Muslim societies, has been destroying them. And the really sad thing about groups like ISIS, they've allowed themselves to be manipulated in a place that they're acting as tools of the very Western regime change policy that are destroying their countries. But you're right, but you know, this is where they get part of their appeal, is precisely by the media presenting them as these bad boys who are against the West and so on. They're not. They're fulfilling Western policy, but it absolutely is crucial to their recruitment to be able to pose as the new anti-Western bad boys on the block, because there is anger at the West, and you're right. The airstrikes, of course, feed into this narrative that the West sees ISIS as a deadly enemy, which it still doesn't. It still sees it as a very useful tool to achieve its goals, which haven't changed. So, absolutely, bombing is not effective in terms of reducing ISIS's power, but is effective at acting as a recruiting sergeant. I'd agree with that.
Martin was talking before the news about the Paris attacks, Dan, saying, well, actually, there's a lot of questions still about whether there was actually any real Syria refugee stroke migrant involvement in those attacks at all, since everybody's been killed, apart from one person apparently who's been on the run. I just wonder what you think about the causes which were being given as to why, I mean, actually, under international law, David Cameron is claiming that Britain is under attack after the Paris attacks, and therefore that bombing Syria is something that Britain can do under international law, under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, in self-defence.
Well, look, here's the great irony again, is that, yes, if you do destroy societies, then you make people hate you, and if you destroy states, then you turn them into, you know, training, basically giant training camps. If you turn over the armories of states and create failed states in which militias can go and raid the armories and from throughout the region go and arm themselves, as has happened with Libya. Libya was basically the 2011 bombing campaign had the effect of turning over the entire armory of a modern industrialized state to the region's most sectarian, violent death squads and militias like Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and so on. So yeah, if you create that misery, and then you create the conditions in which sectarian groups can thrive, and of course can fund themselves, because failed states are also the passage for the drugs that come up over the sea of the Atlantic and then up through North Africa, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and so on, fund themselves with that trade and various other trades, the oil trade. So you create failed states, you can create the three conditions necessary for those kind of groups to begin to operate as global players. You create the misery for recruitment, you create this means of financing themselves, and you give them the weapons and destroy the state power. So absolutely, that is creating a danger then for the entire world. So in that sense, you know, there's true to say, you know, these kind of groups are threat to the globe and so on. But what's missing there is any understanding, and this is throughout the House of Commons debate, this total denial of, well, hasn't the West been the main force that's been creating the conditions for these groups to flourish? And isn't this very strategy of airstrikes actually feeding into doing more of the same? So, yeah, it is dangerous to have turnover states and their armories to these groups.
I totally
so I would
agree
argue that's
with
the reason
Dan.
Not to do that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dan. But I also think that apart from the false flag operations that Martin referred to, the idea that Cameron says that it is our right to go there and we'll be defending ourselves and the security of Britain is totally absurd. The jihadists that have been actually manufactured, created, they are all over the world. There are 80 countries are going there. I mean, these threats can happen anywhere. Whether false flag operations or actual jihadist threat, they could be anywhere. And in fact, these threats actually multiplies this threat to the British citizens. But I really genuinely believe that this is not the concern of David Cameron and his cohort, because they're actually feeding on this.
Yeah, I mean, it fits into their domestic plans to create a police state with full police and security, full security state spying powers and full police powers of repression to get all the legal tools in place before the next economic crash. So that when there are, you know, when the cash machines dry up and, you know, there are millions of people with no prospect of job and no benefits, when these conditions emerge, they've got the full legal apparatus of repression ready in place. And ISIS and the so-called threat of terror attack absolutely justifies all of that and effectively emotionally sort of marches the House of Commons into voting for all of that stuff. So so absolutely, it works for him on every level, really.
If I just add to that, the legality of this is completely to be questioned. I mean, I've been reading legal opinions by people who know about international law, which say that there is no legal basis for you to bomb inside Syria. And Assad's pointed this out. The Russians have taken the line, well, we don't think there's any legal basis for you to be here, but we are prepared on a pragmatic basis to cooperate with you. But I'd just like to hear the comments from both of the other contributors. It's come out in the last 48 hours that coalition forces, they didn't specify the Americans, killed three Syrian soldiers in an airstrike in Syria, which was then followed by an ISIS attack upon their position. And of course, if we're going to get into a situation where the coalition, including the RAF, are acting as the air force, either for the moderate rebels or for ISIS, then we're on a collision course with the Syrian Arab Army, which has taken over 60,000 casualties fighting these people, and the Russian Air Force. And it puts the Russians and the Syrians in a very difficult position, because although they've made it clear that they're not very happy about having this intervention by powers which have not actually got a legal basis to be there, on a pragmatic basis, they've tended. I mean, for Hollande, Putin was saying to Hollande, okay, we will, you know, as long as you tell us what your planes are doing, we'll tell you what our planes are doing. And of course, the Russians believe that the shooting down of their plane was because they were giving information to NATO about where their planes were, which was why the Turks were able to shoot them down as easily as they were. And the other thing that's happening, which needs to be recognised, is that the Turks have sent a military force into Iraq near Mosul. The suggestion I've read is that they are trying to protect ISIS's supply lines. But the Iraqi government has said, you've got to get out of there because we don't want you in there. And that there's also suggestions in the Iraqi parliament that they want to break the link with Britain and America, kick them out, and bring the Russians in to take on ISIS properly. So we're reaching a kind of point where all of these things are coming to a head.
Well, in relation to the illegality of it, yes, it's absolutely illegal, and in fact, it's a war crime. Britain didn't have any legality, either at the United Nations Charter or a Chapter 7, to go to Syria. Now, in relation to Turks going into Iraq, the Americans, 200 special forces are going to be sent to Iraq, and al-Abadi has actually objected to that. They have
said on this business of legality, surely we're way beyond that. I mean, we started with an illegal war in Iraq. I mean, the attack on Libya was really sticking two fingers up at the Russians and the Chinese over the UN Security Council. And so we're moved beyond that, haven't we, Dan?
Once you see that that this is a war against, as you say, against Syria and Russia, and not a war against ISIS. In fact, a war that aims to utilize ISIS in that war against Russia and Syria. Once you see that, everything falls into place. They've been shooting down Russian planes, as you say. There's troops being sent illegally to Iraq. Because remember, there's been this 4+1 coalition that's built up in opposition to the Western-sponsored death squads in Syria, which has been Russia, Syria, Iran, Iraq, and Hezbollah. And, you know, especially the Russian intervention, direct intervention in Syria, began 2 months ago, that we really must be very naive to think, will the West just let their, you know, they've for 4 years been saying, Assad must go. You know, we're going to destroy the Syrian state. We've staked our credibility on it. You know, we've put it on the line. That's what's going to happen. And do you think they're going to let the Russians defeat that project without throwing everything they've got into the fire? They are at war with Russia and Syria now. That's absolutely correct, and Iraq as well, because Iraq actually does want to fight ISIS, and as you say, it wants the help of the people who actually also want to fight these groups, which is Russia. So they're not going to let Iraq. They didn't spend $3 trillion on a war in Iraq in order to see it stabilize itself in alliance with Russia. Certainly not. So they're going to throw everything they've got into this fight. It's very, very dangerous.
I think it's just time, because I interviewed for our dialect programme earlier this week, which you can see used to be on BCFM here, but it's not anymore. You can only get it as a podcast, I'm afraid. That's on www.dialectradio.co.uk. I interviewed from the US website 21st Century Wire a chap called Patrick Henningsen earlier this week, and I hope you can manage to stay with us. Totally totally understand if you can't, Dan, but I just thought I'd be interested to get his take on where he thought this was all heading, and really from a almost sort of stick Patrick Henningsen on a satellite orbiting the Earth, or maybe even on the moon, looking down from a completely his own perspective, in order to try and cut through some of what the mainstream media and many of our MPs have been telling us about this conflict.
Mm. It's no secret to anyone that NATO intelligence is active and egging on instability in the Ukraine and now in the Crimea. And there's also reports of Chechenian Islamist fighters, many of whom have done the rotation in Syria, are now fighting in the Crimea. They've had attacks on Crimean infrastructure, specifically the electrical grid, in the last couple of weeks. Plus, you have the neo-Nazi factions, that right sector factions NATO's been working with. This is a really, really ugly a multi-front war that's being fought against Russia, essentially. That's my opinion of it. If you look at the Ukraine, Crimea, and Syria, NATO got away with murder in Libya by cheating a UN resolution, but at the same time, they hamstrung potential future operations. So basically, that was the final sort of card, if you will. They laid their whole hand on the table in Libya. And to me, that's that was the death knell of NATO as we once knew it, and it must be replaced by an EU army. And we've had calls from various leaders. Tony Blair mentioned it in his speech at the Henry Kissinger lecture series just a few days ago. David Cameron and Angela Merkel are doing some horse trading with regards to the EU, and the quid pro quo is Britain's going to be more considerate towards this idea of an EU army. But basically, Tony, I think it's a done deal. But it's just finding the political structures in public to make it seem like it's a good thing to have a federal army in Europe.
That's Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire there. Dan, if you're still with us, I wonder if you'd just like to round up by saying where you think, I mean, just give us a crystal ball. Where's this all heading?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to say, but one of the main reasons it's difficult to say is because it's so horrifying to actually articulate where it looks like it's going. And where it looks like it's going, as you say, is a World War III scenario. They're increasingly openly at war with Russia now. It's been an economic war for a couple of years. It's been a war of containment for much longer than that. All of these wars are against multiple enemies. And the war against Libya and the war against Iraq, of course they're wars against Libya and Iraq, but they're also, and the war against Syria is most definitely a war against Iran as well as against Syria, Syria being Iran's only Arab ally, and its link, crucially, to Hezbollah, which is the only thing that stops Iran getting blitzed by the Israelis, or one of the main effective deterrents they have, at least, against an Israeli attack on Iran. So the war in Libya, you know, Libya, basically they'll take out powers that they feel potentially are powers that are could contribute serious resources or muscle of some sort to Iran and China. They're trying to isolate Iran and China by picking out their regional allies and wiping them out. And now we've got to a stage where we've had economic war that's developed into all our economic war for the last year and a half, and now it increasingly is a shooting war under the guise of, oops, sorry, that was a mistake, or, oh, that was just a little one-off response to a little incursion. But, you know, it's only going to escalate. I can't see it not escalating. And that's the unfortunate reality that we seem to be sleepwalking into. People are talking about comparisons of 1914. And whilst, of course, there are many differences, there are many similarities. And just to finish, I think one thing that struck me again in the debate in the House of Commons was how we really need to stop just fantasizing history and actually really do learn the lessons. Because there's a lot of Hillary Benn's argument for supporting airstrikes and ISIS was basically boils down to, well, imagine ISIS were the Nazis and imagine it's the 1930s. That was basically his argument. And there were many, many parallels about fascism. They always wheel out this issue of, oh, well, you know, we've tried appeasement. Hitler doesn't work. These kind of people, you can't appease them. You have to fight them. The real lesson, the real truth about the 1930s and the rise of Hitler, where the comparison of fascism and ISIS is really worth paying attention to, is that Hitler was brought to power and supported and bankrolled by the West, by the Western banking institutions. He couldn't have armed himself without them. And he was pushed into war with Russia. He was, you know, given Czechoslovakia on a plate. He was practically ordered to send his armies east. You know, he was basically, you know, given the absolute green light to march his armies into Russia. He was bankrolled and equipped to do so. And, you know, the Western banking institution built him up for that reason. Now, there's the real parallel with ISIS, is once again, we have the West building up these groups to throw them into war against Russia. And so that's the situation we kind of sleepwalking into. So there is a real comparison with both the 30s and the 1910s here, and that's very worrying indeed.
Yeah, okay. Dan, can you just remind us whereabouts we can find you online or even meet you in person? I don't know if you're doing any talks or that sort of thing, about your book as well.
Okay, well, thank you. So I don't have a website of my own, but I regularly publish on RT, on the op-edge section of the RT website, sometimes contribute to Middle East Eye, and I've got an article coming out in the next few days on Telesur on this very issue. And my book's called Divide and Ruin, The West Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis, and that is available online from Amazon, or people can email me at danglazebrook2000@yahoo.co.uk, and I can send you a copy myself, as I'm sure there are people who don't necessarily want to support Amazon, so yeah, that's another option.
Okay, Dan Glazebrook, journalist and author, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Many thanks.
Now, Mernaz Shahabi, you'll be sitting there patiently, you're chipping in from time to time, but I wonder if you can give us a picture of some of, because one of the most confusing things about this conflict in Syria is the number of different sort of rebel groups that there are, and it doesn't seem like it's just like the ISIS and the Free Syrian Army anymore. We're getting told, given all sorts of terms to refer to the various different groups in Syria, al-Nusra. I wonder if you can just help clear that one up a little bit.
Well, yes, I've actually been discussing this with my Syrian friends to try to understand about these different groups. There are so many. As far as the Free Syrian Army is concerned, it was really disbanded in early 2013, if it ever really existed in any form. Or it was sort of dissolved into these jihadi groups, al-Nusra, al-Qaeda groups. Now, there are three main groups. One is al-Nusra, which is really an offshoot of al-Qaeda. Now, there's the Ahrar al-Sham, which is another jihadist group, very violent, and its leader has been al-Qaeda, and there are al-Qaeda members in it. And the other one, Jaish al-Islam, which is, again, hardline Islamists. And its leader, actually, in January, it threatened to bomb Damascus with hundreds of missiles, and actually warned it said to the Sunni population to stay inside, and said our targets are the Alawites and the Christians and other minorities. So these are supposed to be the moderate rebels that British government is supporting.
Well, that sounds like a bit of a gesture, doesn't it? Because, I mean, if they're saying you people stay inside and everyone else go outside, people are obviously not going to do that if they think the missiles
are coming. Well, they actually did launch a missile attack, not then, but after a while, and they killed quite a number of people and injured many. And the other one is, of course, the Jaish al-Mujahideen, which is composed of many Chechen fighters. They are basically foreign fighters. But all these groups, what they have in common is that they are being funded by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and they are full of mercenaries, so in no way they are representing true Syrian opposition. They are terrorists.
I think that's right. Many of them are from outside Syria. That's quite clear.
Yes, yeah.
Many of them have come in via Turkey. And of course, what the Russians have been pointing out since their plane has been shot down is that this is the main way in which these people have come into Syria, and the main way in which they're supplied, armed, and their finances are sorted out. And of course, what the Syrian Arab Army, the Kurdish militias, and the Russian Air Force are doing is closing down that supply line. And that's why their plane was shot down by Erdogan.
Yeah.
And of course, he didn't do it without clearing it with Obama. And Obama said Turkey has got the right to defend its airspace, completely avoiding the point that the plane wasn't in their airspace. And in any case, you're not allowed to shoot planes down or enter into your airspace by accident anyway. And of course, from the Russian point of view, as Lavrov pointed out, is the only way they could have shot it down is because we, in, out of the goodness of our hearts, have been telling NATO exactly what we're up to in Syria, giving you full details of all of our flight plans and everything, so that we don't have any silly accidents. This wasn't a silly accident. This is a deliberate provocation.
Oh, it's an ambush, wasn't it?
It puts the Russians in a very, and the Syrians in a very difficult position. Because if they don't respond, then people within Syria will think that they are weak and that they can't respond and they don't dare to respond and that they will therefore be put on the back foot. If they do respond, they will then be accused of escalating the situation.
Yes, yeah. Well, I noticed one of the comments from the Russian leader Vladimir Putin this week was, well, the Turks have invited us to a war, but we have declined.
Well, the other thing, of course, we haven't mentioned is the downing of the Russian airliner in Egypt. And I've read suggestions that that wasn't carried out by ISIS, but carried out by intelligence services based in Qatar.
Yeah.
Which is quite likely, I think. And I think also that the bombing of the Syrian army a couple of days ago, the Americans were saying it wasn't us, we were nowhere near. And the suggestion I've made to me is that there was a Qatari Air Force that carried out that.
But also, at the end of last week, wasn't it? Actually, just before our last show we did, I missed this because it was hardly reported. The Israelis also flew a sortie down to Damascus, just literally same evening as the British voted. So, in a way, what we're doing is providing cover for something the Israelis have been wanting to do for the last 30 or 40 years.
What was really irritating to me about the so-called debate in Parliament about all of this, that the discussions of the geopolitical implications if the RAF are shot down by a Russian missile on a bombing mission in support of al-Jaish al-Mujahideen or whatever, what are the implications of that? What if the pilot's captured? What are we going to do then?
I mean, are we in a situation,
no discussion about any
Martin,
of that
but aren't we in a situation now where this is just about literally survival of the fittest, rule by force, law of the jungle?
I think gloves are off. I mean, there was no real discussion about the legality of this intervention. And also, what I was particularly disappointed about this debate in Parliament was there was no discussion, nothing even from Jeremy Corbyn or any of the MPs, about what right does Britain have to carry out regime change operation that it has been calling for in another country, in a sovereign country? I mean, this is against international law. Why didn't anyone bring this up?
Well, we shouldn't lose sight of international law as a lodestar here. That's what the Russians are doing, and the Syrian government. You're not obeying the law, but we're not going to stoop to your level. And I think that's the correct response by them.
One thing that I wanted to mention was actually in relation to the Turkmens that are saying that the Russians have been bombing the Syrian Turkmens. Mm-hmm. And it has been found out that the leader of the Turkmens there has been actually a Turkish citizen. He's the son of a mayor in a province in Turkey.
He's also an activist in the Grey Wolves,
which are a
banned terrorist group inside Turkey, frequently used by MIT, the Turkish intelligence.
So are you implying here, Martin, that a group that's banned in Turkey, a Grey Wolves right-wing terrorist group of some sort, which is banned in Turkey, is out now and managing to thrive across the border over in Syria?
In Syria.
Indeed it is, and they're working very closely with Turkish intelligence services. Now, in other words, none of this background to the actual conflict was discussed in the debate, and of course the main opposition that Corbyn and others was to say, oh well, it's very complicated, we don't want to bomb because we might kill civilians. All true, But of course, what they really should have been saying, hang on a minute, Britain is actually in the dock here for starting the war in Syria. Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointed the finger at Britain. And I'm sure, quite sure, that there are people in British special forces who've been in Turkey, who've been in Jordan, who've been working with these very groups that we are bombing.
Now, one of the main reasons which was given in the debate last week in the House of Commons, in fact, the main reason, was the attack on Paris, and this was seen as a reaction to that. So I asked Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire what he made of those.
The Paris attacks, you look at what's come out of it. It's shutting down European borders, talk about free society is a bad thing, freedom of movement is a bad thing, we need to launch more, send more troops, more military assets to the Middle East to fight ISIS, when in fact the Paris attacks, there is no real forensic case, Tony, that puts ISIS in Paris, just as there is no actual forensic case that puts ISIS in the Sinai blowing up the Russian plane, nor ISIS in Beirut with the recent Beirut bombings, and or San Bernardino. So, but yet you hear these all rattled off in a list by politicians and media people as if it's like a script that they have to basically repeat this checklist of ISIS has now got a global reach. And a lot of this can be definitely be an illusion, Tony. I like looking at the forensic case, and in the case of San Bernardino, we can't put the the female shooter especially at the scene of the shooting. No one can ID her. They said they're wearing masks. She's a 5'4", 120-pound Pakistani housewife. The likelihood of her carrying body armor and a full tactical package and firing a .223 automatic Smith & Wesson rifle is a laughable scenario. Yet this is what is put across as the official story.
Has anybody positively identified them at the scene actually doing the shooting?
No, they haven't. This is something about this case, Tony, that's been glossed over. You could potentially ID a male, of a certain, 5'11", 6', because they're both supposedly masked. The reports are the shooters were masked. So there is no support to the idea that the wife, the Muslim housewife who is cooking chicken korma, for her husband is going to be G.I. Jane overnight. Just like there is no forensic evidence to put anybody from Syria at the Paris shootings. We do have a fake Syrian passport, which by all intents and purposes looks to be planted at the scene. And also a German minister agrees with me on that. So again, but the talking point, Tony, was that the migrant crisis bled into, cause a terrorist event in the heart of Europe. That was the narrative. And they acted immediately. And all these sort of policies are coming into place fast and furious. To me, Paris looks like a classic Gladio-style event. And if you look at the policies and the political objectives that were achieved from Paris, it's almost identical in a way to what Gladio sought to achieve through its activities and through various proxy groups and whatever terrorist groups, political extremist factions and so forth. So instead of working through communist parties or the extreme political left or right in Europe, they're just basically using the illusion of Islamic extremist terrorist groups in order to sort of perform the same exact acts, basically.
Well, it's interesting that Patrick mentions Gladio there. We talk about that quite frequently on this program. It's not as if these kind of false flag attacks are some kind of new phenomenon. There is overwhelming evidence that NATO intelligence services have carried out acts of terrorism within Western European countries, killing innocent civilians in order to create certain political effects. And this is because of the investigations by the Italian police force over 30 years. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, the retired head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has written a book about this, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, where on the basis he was the investigating magistrate on many of these events. The evidence is overwhelming that NATO is a terrorist organization.
Patrick was talking there about the San Bernardino shootings. Yep. I've seen several very credible articles now, many eyewitnesses, even journalists now, saying that it looks like there were three shooters, not two shooters, and even photographs
There's various eyewitnesses, and they've been on the mainstream media in the US saying that, well, there were three shooters, and they were all wearing camo, and they all looked like pros, which is very much similar to what happened in Paris, where the people who were all dead are all drug addicts, dope fiends, boozers, and mental health cases, who happen to be Muslims. They're all dead.
It doesn't seem to
and
be
the various people who actually did all the shooting.
The other
have disappeared into
characteristic
the
is it doesn't seem to be any kind of judicial process going to happen in Paris or in San Bernardino.
Well, indeed, that
everyone
is very
being
suspicious, isn't it? You'd have thought when an incident like that happens that it would take ages to work out what has actually happened and to find the timelines and all the rest.
We're also, it seems, moving towards a shoot to kill policy here in Britain, which was very controversial when it was talked about in Northern Ireland, but it's happening day after day now. Police often killing people rather than actually trying to arrest them. Well, anyway, Mayor, I wonder what you make of the accusations of potential false flags with mercenaries, special forces being used to carry out these attacks, and then patsies, people being basically fitted up for them.
Well, as I said before, whether they are false flag operations, I'm sure many of them are. Like, for example, it's very interesting that passports are found in these locations. Do terrorists who want to carry out terrorist actions carry passports with them? But even if some of them are not false flag operations, they are not justifications for attack on a sovereign state. You see, the attack on a sovereign state is going to just increase the sense of resentment. And all these jihadists are all over the place. So that is not going to stem the tide of terrorism.
It's a bit difficult, isn't it, to actually think, well, what would be the purpose of doing this? But I asked Patrick Henningsen finally about what he thought was the big agenda behind all this.
Oil is a part of it. Gas is maybe a bigger part of it than even oil is in terms of sub-regional dominance. Gas is emerged as incredibly important in that respect. Certainly Syria is sitting on top of great deposits. There's a report that just came out that showed that this had been proven in 2005, and all of a sudden we saw hostilities being ramped up after that. But oil and gas, plus we have just the military industry, Tony, that in itself is a juggernaut now. This is a multi-hundred-trillion-dollar global industry. That's a juggernaut. We have so many different factors that feed into this. Plus, you have the socio-economic, plus the religious aspects of it. You have old power plays, old geographic power plays of the Halford Mackinder flavor with Eurasia. Plus, we have the situation with Israel, and you have to look at Israel. Everyone's turned their head away from what's been going on in Jerusalem and the West Bank because of this latest crisis. So, again, that's ongoing. That's not stopping, nor is the battle for the Sinai Peninsula. That's an ongoing. We still have peacekeepers in the Sinai, U.S. troops, 700 of them, to basically watch what Egypt and Israel are doing in the Sinai Peninsula. So still today, after all these years. So these are all live plays, as is Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of pressure on the Saudi monarchy right now, too, on many fronts. And I there's noises coming out of CIA that, I quote, the Saudi royal family is not long for this world. End of quote. I heard that last week from a CIA operative.
Well, what I also see is that this long-time plan of the Balkanization of the region is being carried out. For example, now we hear about this Sunnistan in Iraq, with Turkey invading Iraq and allying with the corrupt Kurdish regional government in Kurdistan, trying to basically, they are going there to stay, and they are claiming it's that sort of pre-Ottoman, the Ottoman Empire dream of expansionism. Now they are trying to recover the parts of Syria that they believe belong to them and parts of Iraq that they believe to belong to them, and together with the Kurds to create a Sunni region, a Sunni country that will be under their thumb. And the same thing is happening in Syria as well, breaking the region up, breaking the country up into Sunni, Shia, Kurds. So I see that that project is being carried out, but also it is the question of the energy, the massive amounts of energy which has been found in the Eastern Mediterranean, 1.8 billion barrels of oil.
Well, perhaps that's what most of this
122 trillion cubic feet of
gas. Martin, I just ask you to pick up on one point that Dan made there, which we sort of let hang in the air. Are we at war with Russia?
Effectively, yes. But I think what I said earlier, the way the Russians are handling this is, we are not going to break international law just because you do. They are actually playing for a rejigging of the international system so that international law, currently completely ignored, becomes a viable force. And that, of course, is a rational strategy, because the vast majority of humanity eventually will realise who is the defenders of legality and who isn't. And, of course, on that basis, I'd just like to mention the chemical weapons attack 2 years ago at Ghouta. Not only was it not carried out by the Assad regime, the evidence showed it was carried out by NATO.
I noticed the
We killed those children. That's a red line.
Also, China has weighed in, hasn't it, saying that it wants there to be an anti-ISIS massive coalition, including possibly the rebels too.
Well, in actual fact, the Turkmen mentioned earlier, they are basically from outside Syria, and they're basically Turkic-speaking people, some of which are based in the Uyghur region in China, and they have terrorist attacks being carried out in, separatist terrorist attacks being carried out in China by Turkish militants, who are armed and trained by the Turkish military. And the Turkish, the Grey Wolves were also, and that's what we're talking about here, were also responsible for the attack on the Hindu temple in Thailand some while ago. That's what the Thai police are saying.
So I think what you're saying from my question at the top of the hour is that the West and the NATO alliance does pose a danger to humanity.
World War III has already started. Let's hope the imperialists lose. They deserve to.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Iranian-born Bristolian anti-war campaigner Mehrnaz Shahabi and journalist Dan Glazebrook, author of Divide and Ruin. Our sister show Dialect has been dropped from BCFM, but is still available as a podcast, and you can hear our special on the withdrawal of funding from the St Paul's Carnival too. That's at this dialectradio1word.co.uk. This show is at thisweek.org.uk, where you can hear links and hear previous shows. I'm Tony Gosling on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable despite all this weekend. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, the last one before Christmas, and don't let the banksters get you down.
News on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.